Hello, I'm Dave Marshall, and you join me here on this episode of PaleoCast on a very typical rainy day in Manchester here in the UK. Both my co-hosts, John and Joe, are off on their academic adventures, so for now, it's just you, me, and the rain. This upcoming 13th episode marks the end of PaleoCast's sixth month in existence, and so I've been looking to put my feet up, get away from the weather, and treat myself to a bit of a vacation. Fortunately, I came across the Best Western Denver Southwest in Colorado and spoke to the owners Greg and Meredith Talley all about their hotel. So joining me today are Greg and Meredith Talley, owners of the Best Western Southwest in Denver. First of all, we're going to start off this interview with a little bit about Nikola Tesla. Now, I'm sure that a lot of you will know that name, but he's not a paleontologist. So could you tell us a little bit about him and how he's relevant to all this?
Certainly. Why Tesla? What does Tesla have to do with some sleepy little hotel in Denver, Colorado? Well, Tesla is probably best known for designing and developing alternating current, or AC, and he was somewhat of a archetypal mad scientist, all kinds of ideas, a crazy dreamer. In his mid to late years, he was involved down in Colorado Springs with some of his larger lightning experiments. And if you think about sort of the Frankenstein's lab, lightning bolts crackling across the mountains and prairies of Colorado, those were done here. Now, Tesla has a museum. There's only one structure in the United States that's still associated with him, and that's in Long Island, New York, and that's Wardenclyffe. Now, Wardenclyffe was endangered, and there was a campaign to save it. Even though Wardenclyffe was immediately after Colorado Springs, Colorado Springs was like 1899 to 1900, and then Tesla moved on to New York to work with, George Westinghouse. Wardenclyffe was a fizzling little coda to his career, not very productive, and I think he wrapped that up right around World War I. So, but nonetheless, there's another group of crazy dreamers in the New York area that wants to celebrate Tesla and his sort of mythology and his life and legacy.
One reason why people find Tesla so fascinating is because, yes, he did some interesting things scientifically, but he was also kind of an interesting guy. He had visions. He was the kind of person who he was not what you would call a linear thinker. As a student, he would get in trouble because he couldn't necessarily tell the steps that he had used to get to an answer. He just knew the answer, and he does kind of fit the archetype of a mad scientist, because he had all these ideas and they just seemed to come out of nowhere, just come right at him. And that makes him kind of more interesting, that he wasn't, sort of a methodical plotter. He really had amazing ideas, that just sort of seemed to come out of nowhere, almost like visions.
And he had just an amazing intuitive ability to sew together random facts into a new hole and reach a conclusion. And he also was, you know, sort of what we would think of more as the artist type and less the businessman, you know, the one who was penniless, but, you know, still had big dreams and visions. He was an iconoclast.
I know how he feels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and he was an iconoclast. Some of his influences were like Goethe and Mark Twain and Voltaire. So he affiliated himself with the underdog. Now, where his life gets a little weird and interesting was he, you know, believed in numerology and sort of some New Age occult stuff. And his life has been wrapped in a lot of things like UFO theories and death rays and conspiracy theories. And, so his life has taken on its own mythology. We call him, Meredith and I call him the American scientific Christ, in that, you know, he has his own passion play where the evil Thomas Edison persecuted him to promote his own agenda, and he was crushed. And there's already, a whole mythology of supernatural things surrounding him.
So what's your connection to him other than both living in Colorado?
Well, it has to do with a crowdfunding campaign run through Indiegogo.com and through Matt Inman, better known as The Oatmeal, a comic writer who draws and illustrates online and is a master at social media. And so, Meredith and I have always been interested in sort of weird Colorado history, and Tesla has always fit into that. And so Matt, to help the Wardenclyffe people, offered it for $33,333 a chance to write up you, your business, and all of that. And since we were already rebranding as a Natural History Museum Extension, it just seemed like the right fit.
Well, I have to tell you, when Greg came to me and said, Matt Inman is offering this deal, and anyone who will give this charitable donation gets a cartoon written about them. And I said, how much is the charitable donation? And he said, $33,333. And for about 5 seconds, I thought he was completely insane. Yes, I did think he was crazy. But Greg has always had really good intuition about this stuff. And he convinced me that this would be really beneficial. And he said the amount of exposure that we'll get from this is far more valuable than that donation. And so he actually won me over pretty quickly. And I said, okay, let's go for it.
It sounds, it's a really generous donation to make for science history. And I think I was right in hearing you say that you're making a museum expansion to your hotel.
Yes, and that's because we have our own unique scientific history to celebrate in the area with Dinosaur Ridge, which is about 10 minutes drive west of the hotel. And, you know, we actually upped our donation to $35,000 to send a clear statement that we unequivocally support science. We support, preserving scientific histories and legacies. And so we did this because it was a good fit and pure win all the way around. We could promote our business. We could support Tesla. We could support what we hope down the road could be a Tesla museum somewhere on the Front Range of Colorado. And definitely to promote our own little cracked in the head idea.
So why did you choose a natural history museum opposed to a Tesla museum at your hotel? Is there any reason why? Is it just particularly because you like dinosaurs?
We like dinosaurs. We like natural history. We like science in general. We have always enjoyed the history of Colorado and of this area. It's all very interesting to us, and we were pretty sure that other people would find it interesting too. And as we have discovered, that's very true. Lots of people are very excited about this project.
And I mean, to use the old cliche from real estate, it's location, 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 baby. Because we have Tesla's really about an hour and a half south of us, whereas Dinosaur Ridge is 10 minutes away next to Red Rocks Amphitheater. And the story that the Oatmeal told with us guiding and informing him about the Bone Wars and about the Western Interior Seaway, about the Morrison Formation, because we're right down the road from Morrison, Colorado. And I mean, in terms of the first glimpse into the past of these Jurassic giants, happened, right outside our front door practically. And, the first Apatosaurus, the first Stegosaurus were dug out of the ground here. We got the type name for, the most productive Jurassic strata, running through all of North America. So we have this crazy amount of Jurassic and Cretaceous history, in one place. And then layered on top of that is the very bitter scientific feud, late 19th century, between O.C. Marsh and E.D. Cope, also known as the Bone Wars. So just a lot going on in a very small area. And we find the human side of the story to be every bit as fascinating as the geologic and the paleontological side of things.
Could you expand upon the geology of the area then, please?
Well, there's this formation that runs north-south along the eastern flank of the Rockies called the Dakota Hogback or Dakota Ridge. Hogback is an American term for if you have a feral pig, their backs tend to get sort of sharp and pointy. So you have one or two ridges of as there was uplift from the Rockies, it pushed these back and formed basins with these rocks protruding out. Now, the Denver Basin has been long filled up with a glacial till and sediment. However, it's exposed quite a bit of Permian or Carboniferous rock all the way up through Cretaceous. And the Permian layer and Carboniferous layer of rock is that beautiful rust red that you get like in the red beds of Texas or in South Africa. And, it has weathered down into these crazy pillars and shapes, red rock hoodoos that form up some of the most iconic landmarks in Colorado, like Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, Red Rocks Amphitheater, the Flatirons in Boulder, Vedawe Wilderness up in Wyoming. And so that's one layer. And then it's usually backdropped by the Rocky Mountains proper, like Pikes Peak. So it's very, very photogenic. Moving up from there, you have the Morrison Formation, where in 1877, a school teacher named Arthur Lakes, who was also a self-taught geologist, discovered some of the first bone beds and informed both Marsh and Cope about that. So you have both the Bone Wars and you have, our first glimpse into the Jurassic past of animals that weren't just, there were dinosaurs discovered, Sir Richard Owen had discovered some, the first hadrosaurs and things have been discovered on the East Coast. But these were elephant to horse size, hippo size, still kind of in the realm of what modern humanity understood animals to be on the large side of things. When you got into Morrison Formation and some of these early bone beds, and we were looking at house size animals, school bus, size animals, semi trucks or lorry size animals. And it absolutely blew everyone's mind away, at least in the scientific community. It took another 30 years around the turn of the century for it to catch the public's imagination. But there was always interest from the beginning. And then moving up above that, you have the Dakota Formation, the eponymous name for the whole ridge. And that is when Colorado, the Rockies weren't fully formed, and you had Colorado and all of North America split into sort of two subcontinents with a warm, shallow sea running north-south between. And it's called many, many names like Niobrara Sea or Western Interior Seaway, which is probably the most common name for it. But you had the western half of the United States called Laramidia, and then you had Appalachia on the eastern side. And inside this corridor were some of the deadliest sea critters ever known in the history of life. They were toothsome, gruesome, enormous, and very, very rapacious and ravenously hungry. So I think people are fascinated with them, because if you ever had to take a dip in ancient seas, the Western Interior Seaway would have been a fantastic way to die quickly and spectacularly.
I don't think you often use the term critters there, do you?
It's scientific.
Yeah, we know that one from you guys, from you Americans. So it does sound like you've got quite a lot of important critters living about in there. So could you tell us a little bit about the history of the research that's been going on? You mentioned the Bone Wars. What were those?
Well, your expert is drinking coffee, so I will do my best to answer that. The Bone Wars, in my opinion, don't get nearly enough attention, and it's actually a really fun and fascinating story. You have two scientists, both very, very interested in ancient creatures of the ancient world. They should have been friends. Marsh and Cope should have been the best of friends, and in fact, they did kind of start out as friends. They had similar interests. If they had been able to work together, it would be astonishing what they could have accomplished. They were not able to work together because of both being extremely, extremely competitive. And so they ended up kind of working almost as hard to destroy each other as they were to discover interesting new things. And in the end, they both kind of died defeated and alone, in spite of the fact that they had made amazing scientific discoveries.
The Bone Wars is a Wild West opera written large that ended up kind of as a tragedy, a Greek tragedy in its own right. Like Meredith mentioned, they both died penniless and alone. Picture the 19th century with sort of these guys had this Zelig or Forrest Gump who's who of people from that time, like Buffalo Bill and Crazy Horse and Red Cloud and Darwin and Huxley, Ulysses S. Grant, and the list goes on, and they were in the middle of all of this working very, very hard to destroy one another and have this sort of gold rush, but with bones versus minerals. And, you know, picture claim jumping. They would sew false fossils to fake each other out. They would spy on one another. There were fist fights, with some of their hired guns. The most criminal thing of all is that Marsh ordered some of the fossils destroyed, because it was a zero-sum game. And like a lot of bitter blood feuds, it started out as blood brothers and ended up just in complete zero-sum destruction.
So some important fossils got smashed to bits because he would rather have had them smashed to bits than have them end up in the hands of his archenemy.
That's pretty bad. I don't think I'd do that. And I hope that no one else would nowadays.
Let this be a lesson to you, kids. Stay in school and don't destroy fossils.
So what were some of the species that they found?
If you took your standard children's bag of dinosaurs and dumped it out on the table, A lot of the fauna in there would be things that either Marsh or Cope's or their supernumeraries discovered. We already mentioned Apatosaurus, you know, which was Brontosaurus for, you know, over a century, Stegosaurus, Allosaurus, Camarasaurus, you know, out on in the plains of Kansas, which was the bottom of the Western Interior Seaway. They Marsh discovered toothed birds, Hesperornis, you know, a lot of the larger sea monsters were discovered, if not necessarily by them directly, by people who they worked with and sort of trained up. You know, probably the most important discoveries were not necessarily dinosaurs, but Marsh's contribution to putting actual data on Darwin's theory. He's the one who, you know, sort of put the meat on the bones with horses. And in 1876, when America was celebrating its centennial, and right around the, actually it was early August when Colorado was admitted into the Union as a state. That's why we're the Centennial State, is our motto. You had Darwin's bulldog, Huxley, cross the Atlantic for a lecture series, and he went almost immediately to Princeton and the Peabody Museum to meet with Marsh. And Marsh, almost like a magician, started producing, I believe it was like 33 different species of horse, and took it from like this three-toed, four-toed, tiny little fox-sized forest dweller all the way through to modern draft horse, you know, like a Clydesdale. And he also produced that Hesperornis bird, that 8-foot flightless bird that sort of looked like a penguin with a bad attitude. And it was a further proof that birds evolved from dinosaurs and that birds used to have teeth. So a delighted Huxley took this and started lecturing to a very rapt audience in New York City, and you know, and then took those ideas, and Darwin was so pleased that he wrote a letter of thanks to Marsh. So really, before Dinosaur Ridge, you know, if you were going to be a serious paleontologist working in the Western United States, you would focus on Ice Age animals. That was the true scientific excitement because of Marsh's work with horses.
So, Dinosaur Ridge is close to you. Were a lot of those fossils found there?
Well, Dinosaur Ridge is part of the Dakota Hogback, right next to Red Rocks. And yes, that's where Arthur Lakes first discovered the Jurassic bones and shipped off a crate to Marsh and shipped off a crate to Cope. And roughly the same time, there was another bone bed discovered down near Canyon City, which is actually still very productive to this day. And then immediately after that, the most productive Jurassic bone bed in the world at Como Bluff was discovered. And so they worked for about a season and a half at Dinosaur Ridge. And then they moved on because it was much easier to extract the bones from down south and up north.
One of the reasons why Dinosaur Ridge is so popular with tourists is because there's a panel kind of against the Hogback that tells a story. And there are some large footprints, some small footprints of the same type, and then some predator footprints coming right at it.
And that's on the Cretaceous level, on the, you know, one up from the Morrison Formation, or several up from the Morrison Formation, and that's the Dakota Formation, where it looks like some sort of iguanodont mom was shadowing her, you know, baby and protecting it. And then there are some predator footprints. It was some sort of, you know, ornithomimid or something, some sort of egg eater. And it was possible, if it happened at the same time, that this was mudflats or beachside shoreline, and that they were migrating north-south, and there was a smaller predator checking out the baby, and the mom was having none of it. And this was exposed when the Civil Conservation Corps in the middle of the Great Depression was building a road to go back to Red Rocks Amphitheater, and they blasted and uncovered this phenomenal panel that is still one of the centerpieces of Dinosaur Ridge today.
But every school kid in the area visits this place on a field trip at some point. And it captures the imagination of kids because it's, you know, I mean, bones are fascinating, but you can actually see kind of a story happening here. And kids always get caught up in the story of the big iguanodon protecting the little one while a predator is menacing them.
Well, I mean, with Marsh and Cope, you got to understand, these guys have massive personalities, massive egos. They were going out into the middle of the Indian Wars. You know, in fact, Marsh was right around Little Bighorn when Custer was massacred, and you had very angry groups of various plains peoples, you know, out to kill any whites or intruders. And he was out digging with the permission of some of the groups, and some other groups didn't care. You know, there were hawks and doves within, you know, the various war parties. And so if you're willing to waltz into the middle of a war zone and dig up bones, you're going to have a massive ego, and you're going to butt heads with your rivals. So I call them both kind of noble bastards. They did great things and they did terrible things. Marsh, his other big claim to fame is he took on the entire Ulysses S. Grant administration when he was at one of the forts just before Little Bighorn. And Red Cloud, sort of more on the moderate to dove side of things amongst the Plains Indians, showed him how corrupt the reservation system was, how all of these commercial contractors were giving, you know, the worst, most subpar kind of food and pocketing the profits. And Marsh took samples of everything and filed them away and promised to pursue it. And Red Cloud, you know, after dealing with a long string of white people who, you know, never kept their word, sort of was like, yeah, whatever. So, but then Marsh went back to the East Coast and he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And in newspaper articles and in going to D.C., he met with Grant himself. He met with the Department of Interior was at the time. And he actually had several members of the administration, you know, go down in flames because of this, quote, Indian ring. It was one of many, you know, rings or scandals that plagued Grant's administration. And later on, you know, Red Cloud came into another station where one of Marsh's men was packing up a bunch of fossils, and he gave that guy his best peace pipe, and he said, "You give this to Marsh. He is the best white man I've ever known." And Marsh's motives behind that may have been more self-promotional, to make himself look good. You know, he is an enigma who is impossible to know or fully understand. And his greatest strength and greatest downfall was his bulldog teeth. When he would sink his teeth into something, he would not let go until he was done. This singular sort of idéfix guy. And that allowed him to, you know, say, give Darwin and Huxley proof that their theories were correct, or to take down a presidential administration. But it also meant him trying to destroy his rivals and ultimately destroying himself.
It's kind of similar to how I do my interviews. So this sounds like there's so much history going on around there, and so that's your inspiration for what you're doing with your hotel. But how's it gonna manifest itself? What are you actually gonna do?
Well, we're partnering with the two small local museums in the area, and our plan is to donate to their booster societies, and then they will make the purchases and then loan them back to us. We are theming the hotel where you can walk in one hallway and go up the stairs and down another set of stairs, and it will tell the story of life. And there really will be displays on Marsh and Cope and some of the other paleontologists in the area.
So it's going to be half a museum and kind of half a hotel.
It's going to feel like you are spending the night in a museum. And the hallways are a display area. There'll also be a gallery. Even the swimming pool is going to have scary aquatic creatures in it. So you can swim with the dinosaurs. The rooms obviously will be nice hotel rooms. But as you're walking around, you're going to kind of get a tour of ancient life all the way up to early modern Colorado.
The swimming pool is going to roughly follow the contours of the Western Interior Seaway of about 85 million years ago. We're going to have a mural on the bottom of a lot of the animals swimming at the time. We hired a very well-known dinosaur illustrator, Larry Felder, to do the design. And the idea is down the road to do it in Tesserae, but, you know, budget dictates everything. So it's going to be painted for a year or so. And we've already hired a crack team of starving artist interns to work for beer and pizza. But, you know, people will be able to swim with Hesperornis and with the Tylosaurs and Mosasaurs and Elasmosaurus, so that there will be a wide variety of things on the bottom of the pool that could help you die horribly, because that's the kind of place we are. We're a hotel that has all of these ancient animals, but without the death and terribleness. Although our lawyers have informed us that we can't say that there won't be death and terribleness.
I think it's great that you're actually shaping it the same shape as the Western Interior Seaway, which is something I didn't read about when I was doing my background reading on this.
It's a rough shape. It's, you know, it's more abstract, but the general idea is the pool is roughly shaped like the map, and then there's no actual scale to match with the animals. We want them big and large and ravenous.
So is it just going to be based around what's there locally in Colorado, or are you going to expand it, the things in your museum, to some of the fossils from around the world?
It won't be just completely limited to Colorado. Obviously, our focus is going to be North America, but there's so much interesting stuff that we don't want to exclude that it's going to be a little bit of everything.
Well, and you know, you can't just focus on Colorado if you're going to tell the story of life. You know, it does go global, and you know, we're going to have like one of the stairwells we're calling the Stairs of Emergence, and you know, we have an artist friend who's doing some cut murals that'll go up the stairwells themselves, up the railings. And about halfway up, you have the Tiktaalik emerging from the water, and then the rest of the stairwell, you know, keeps going up, and it's you know, takes things onto land. And you know, but we have to talk about the Etikarian fauna. We have to talk about things all over the world because those aren't Colorado based.
Don't forget your sea scorpions as well. That's my pro tip.
Oh, there will be sea scorpions. Don't worry.
Yes.
How could there not be sea scorpions?
You've made me a very happy interviewer.
Don't worry. We'll have a turn down service in your room when you come and visit. We will put a sea scorpion in your bed.
Thank
sea
you.
Cool.
So are you going to have any replicas, big full-scale dinosaurs in there that you can squeeze in?
Oh, we already do.
You already do?
We already do.
We have a statue out front of Stanley the Stegosaurus. He's been on one cross-country trip with us, and he may go in another couple of weeks down to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. We have a 35, 40-foot dig panel of a Tylosaur that will be swimming in our restaurant on the ceiling. We're going to have a dig panel of a Stegosaurus, Stenops, swimming, or not swimming, but behind the front desk. So everything we're doing is going to be parts and casts of various dinosaurs. There's no way we could afford to get the full scale real things in here. I mean, that would, you know, put bankrupt us.
Are you giving it a 1900s feel? Are you putting any plants in there or anything?
What we're trying to do is make the hotel feel like it's a dusty, musty, storied institution that was maybe formed in the 1880s.
It won't really be dusty, though.
No, but something that's been around for quite some time and is settled and has its own ways, and you know, give it a feeling like maybe it grew in different sections, and you know, and things were added on to as the years went by. The swimming pool area is going to feature plants that are living fossils from the late Cretaceous, and we'll have a large specimen garden, you know, of cycads and palms and magnolias and the like, that will, you know, have to go to a greenhouse in the wintertime, but will be interesting and fun in the summer months.
We hope they'll do well here. We'll try.
Are you planning on doing any sort of outreach activity or kind of day trips to Dinosaur Ridge?
Oh, absolutely. We will be giving people tours of our hotel and then sending as much business as we can to the local museums. And so in a way, our hotel is actually going to be an advertisement for the whole area. If there's enough demand, we have actually talked about taking people on our dino bus, which we have yet to own, but it would be fun to have someday. We'll have to see if there actually is enough demand to justify having a shuttle. That would be lots of fun. But in the meantime, even without a shuttle, we do plan to send people that direction. We also plan to do lots of classes, lots of activities for kids, family-friendly activities. And we're going to invite experts to come and speak as well. And in fact, we've already had a lot of people contact us and offer their expertise in various areas. And so there'll be seminars in the evenings that might be just for grown-ups, or some other ideas are there's a local reptile guy that kids just adore. There's a mountain man who talks about Colorado history. That's always a big hit with kids. There's a raptor lady. And so these people will be wandering in and out and doing all kinds of fascinating things that are family friendly.
Are you worried that with such a strong theme that you might lose a lot of customers?
No, we're doing this in a way where it will be tasteful. It will be like a Western style hotel with sort of a decidedly masculine presence. But, you know, rather than having like a reproduction Frederick Remington cowboy statue, there will be an Allosaurus skull. I mean, I know that when you get into dinosaurs, you start to lean towards kitsch and very, very easy. And that's what we're trying to avoid. We use our online presence to sort of drain off all the kitsch and silliness and schmaltz. But the hotel itself will be something where business people would have no problem coming and staying.
And our rooms are going to be quite comfortable. We've always been proud of our hotel. It's always been a nice, comfortable place to stay. There won't be any plastic dinosaurs staring at you once you're inside your room. The rooms are going to be very nice once we finish with the remodel. At the moment, they're more like a construction zone than hotel rooms. But you'll be able to come check in and have a very comfortable stay, whether you're interested in the science and the history of the area or not.
America's quite a polarized country, though, when it comes to paleontology. Are you worried about that at all?
Not really. I mean, it's, you know, we're capitalists and we believe in free market. And if people don't like what we're doing as a business, they don't necessarily have to stay here. We don't find Christianity to be incompatible with a belief in evolution. The history bears that out, and you know, we still have Gideon's Bibles and all the drawers. That's basically just tradition, and they're free. I mean, that's what you get in hotel rooms. But you know, we're not here to be combative. We're here to tell one side of the story, and we're not a public school. We're a business. So,
and we've been very open and upfront about who we are. I think it's no mystery who we are, what we believe, and what we stand for. And so anyone who's not comfortable with that just doesn't have to choose to stay here. There are lots of other hotels that are just fine.
And, you know, you can go all over the United States, and there are Christian fishes on various businesses, and that's sort of a declaration of people's beliefs. But, unless people are really die-hard iconoclasts, I mean, most Americans know you just got to get by and work with one another. And I'm sure if I really dug into it, I would not agree with the majority of the people I do business with on politics or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, everybody's just got to be people.
You said before that it could have been so easy to have fallen into kind of like a cliche or tackiness. Over-theming with Jurassic Park. So it's nice to hear that you're going to be doing a lot of bespoke work and a lot of custom artwork. But even so, how are Best Western taking this?
They've been phenomenal. From the CEO, David Kong, on down, they sort of chuckle and shake their heads at everything that we've done. But they're supportive. I mean, Best Western is a cooperative franchise where it's owner-owned and operated. So, and we all have a vote. For every hotel you own, you have one vote. So, we go to convention and we squabble and we, you know, vote on the new standards or referendum. Occasionally there's some pushback, and so timelines are extended when you have to implement things, you know, with deadlines. But Best Western encourages people to have unique differentiators to set their properties apart, so we're not all just blandy-bland big-box hotels.
Absolutely. Best Western allows you to have your own personality. So, for example, if you have a Best Western in a ski area, they will let you have a sort of mountain chalet theme or, you know, some kind of winter sports theme, if that's your preference. The Best Western that's near the Grand Canyon obviously has a Grand Canyon theme. So it's fine to have your own personality and your own identity within the Best Western brand, as long as you meet their standards of safety and quality and tastefulness, which we do. And we've worked with them all along to make sure that they approve of all the choices that we've made.
In fact, we've got a design meeting right after this. We're sitting down with a couple of Best Western folks to sort of talk about the overall plans. But they've been very supportive, and there's been no blowback. I wish there was more controversy to talk about to date. But so far, we've had overwhelming enthusiasm. Like, our Facebook page has exploded to over 70,000 fans and growing. We've had someone offer us a book deal. We have two different companies bidding on doing a reality TV show based on the hotel and some of the ideas of what we're doing. So, this cartoon has opened up very broad horizons and opportunities for us all. So our profile seems to be going up and up and up and up, all thanks to one cartoon and telling a very compelling story.
Your internet presence seems to be quite an important factor in this story. So do you think that the $35,000 was worth it?
It was a tax write-off. Uncle Sam will probably be cutting us a check. By our estimate, it was about $1 million media buy. I think we have about a third or I think we have about a fifth of Best Western Corporate's global numbers on Facebook. So, yes, I mean, it was a way for not only for us to benefit science and tell an amazing story about Tesla and Dinosaur Ridge, but, you know, we definitely have received a massive benefit from everything.
I think we can safely say that, yes, it was worth it.
And then some.
Okay, well, you can plug us to all your fans. That'd be a nice one.
Sure. Well, if you want to join us, we're at facebook.com/Best Western Denver. We're the ones with the pterodactyl as the little icon or logo. We try to keep our page less about the hotel and more about science and humor. So we are the best motel / museum / humor science content providers you will ever find. I know that's a very, very crowded field of people fitting that description, but you know, we think we can somehow find our way.
So where are you in your refurbishment? When do you expect to be finished?
We hope by Memorial Weekend, late May, just before the, you know, the June busy season. It's construction between bureaucratic delays and renegotiating with the banks and permitting and all of that. You know, we're in a little bit of a lull now, but we hope to hear hammers swinging again next week.
The Geological Society of America, the GSA, are having their annual meeting and exposition in Denver on the 27th and 30th of October. So are you planning anything special for that?
We promise that if they come to our hotel, that if the dinosaur uprising occurs, they will be devoured swiftly and painlessly. It's a perk. we have to get our doors open, but when we get it all nailed down, we will certainly reach out to them and see what we can do.
Absolutely. I think they'd love it here.
And then I guess just as a final one, are you glad that you decided to theme it in this way? Are you having fun doing it?
Yes. I mean, there are some dinosaur-themed hotels. You know, there's even a dinosaur-themed hotel where you can have sex with dinosaurs in Japan. What we're trying to do is a natural history museum hotel, and I don't think that's really been done before. You know, I mean, we want to be a museum hotel, and between that and the social media buy, it's all storytelling. Every last bit of it is telling compelling stories, and that's what we're trying to do, is tell passionate, compelling stories about science, about learning, about the thrill of discovery. And if you have a curious mind, that is an enormously compelling idea.
It's been lots of fun. It's been, because it's so much more creative than just your typical remodel project, it's been a fun, creative project for us to work on. You know, there've been some bumps along the way and kind of some tedious things that we've had to deal with. But that's pretty much typical for any construction project. But the creative side of it has been lots and lots of fun. Just brainstorming ideas, you know, coming up with the artistic vision of it, and then just all the great stuff we've gotten to do, like this podcast, for example, this radio show, the you know, the interest that we've had from people, and kind of our back and forth messages on Facebook with people that have sent us their fan art and just things like that. It's been a great experience.
Well, Greg and Meredith, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem.
Thank you. It was fun.
Let us know when the podcast will air, and we can't wait to hear it.
Will do.
Okay.
I'll come and see you as well. I'll come and stay over when you're open.
Oh, we hope so. Please do.
All right, Dave. Take care. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Thank you very much.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/PaleoCast to get all the latest news.
I don't know what else there is. Can you think of anything else you want to say?
We do want to squash the rumor that we are also running a dinosaur cloning lab, a secret facility.
Don't bring that up.
I mean, it's not. It's our lawyers have advised us to tell everyone that it is not real, and to quit being nosy Parkers and to move along. So,
right.
That the situation is well underhand, and these things that don't exist have not escaped. And there's no reason for the general public to panic. But that's really all we can say.
Greg, you've said too much already. Hush.
All right. Enough. Can we cut this part out?